Welcome to Beyond the Habit.
Moving beyond everyday assumptions of what it means to be Catholic and live the gospel with two Catholic sisters
who are trying to find common ground, create unity, and talk about real life issues.
Led by two sisters of St. Joseph.
That's us. I'm Sister Erin McDonald.
And I'm Sister Colleen Gibson.
Colleen, it's great to be back with you here again this evening, recording another podcast episode. Sorry for being a couple minutes late. I was just eating dinner with a sister with whom I live, and we were finishing our meal, and she asked if I was watching TikTok on my phone. She heard the sounds of it, and so I said, well, yeah.
She knows the sounds of TikTok, but how much TikTok are you watching at home? / were you watching TikTok at dinner?
Listen, I plead the fifth. Okay.
Yeah, anything you say on the podcast cannot, will not be used against you.
Right. Yeah. So of course. And so I said, oh yeah, absolutely. And she said, oh, can I watch some TikToks? So I handed her my phone. And so she was watching TikTok on my phone. And I was watching the clock get closer and closer to our time to record. And so finally, I had to sort of say, I do have to go and record this podcast. And, you know, she said to me, oh, did you want your phone back?
Yeah,
you can watch TikTok on it again later if you want. I mean, you know, God help my algorithms from there forward. But sure, you know, I'm happy to share. It's ours. It's our phone. We hold all things in common, even our TikTok accounts.
Oh, I can't wait for you guys to be doing like TikTok dances together. I think there's something here, you know, there's a call. We're called to be out there in the world, you and your housemate, you know, doing some dances. I don't know anything about TikTok, so I don't know what is, you know.
You're not on TikTok?
I'm not hip. I'm not with it. I only got on Snapchat when I was a campus minister because the students who I was working with, we're like, sister, you have to be on Snapchat. And I was like, wait, so it's a text message that disappears after I've sent it? And so if you ever want to, you know, find me, they've designed my whole Snapchat personality. But I've never, TikTok, not my thing. I don't get it. I don't understand it. But maybe your housemate could convert me, could win me over.
Yeah, that could be possible. I can neither confirm nor deny whether or not I have made such propositions to her in conversation about perhaps recording some TikToks. We've not gotten there yet, but you know, God is good and nothing is too marvelous for God. So
that's beautiful, sister.
Well, and my college students, you know, I work in university ministry. And so Be Real is the happening app these days.
Oh yeah.
So I'm trying to discern whether or not I'm too old to be on Be Real. And really, it's not even so much about age. I'm just not sure my life is interesting enough at times for this whole Be Real thing.
Oh, you're real already, sister. You don't need to be real. You are real in the flesh here. You can only do so much. I think, you know, face-to-face contact, there's something about that.
I love it. See, your spiritual nuggets of wisdom are just so inspiring, Colleen.
Yeah, just, you know, smash that like and subscribe button, everybody out there. You can follow me on Instagram or Facebook. That's, I'm an old lady. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, you know, Be Real. I have not
Hallmark cards. Yeah. You can mail them.
I love mailing a good Hallmark card.
A carrier pigeon, if you still have them.
You want a telegraph? I could send you a telegraph. Da 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 da. This in from Colleen Gibson.
Before we go off the rails too much here with dispelling the image that we are young and hip, we might be ruining our reputations here, sister. But going back to referencing, you know, spiritual nuggets of wisdom, I'm really excited that we have Macaw Black Elk to talk to us here today. And I think it's certainly a random transition here from the wilds of TikTok to the seriousness and importance of reconciliation and justice work. But nonetheless, I think the connection there is just the many different ways that we can all find to engage with our faith and who we are and community it's amazing to me in many ways too, working with young adults, how so many of these social media platforms, when used well, when used discerningly, can also be great tools for inviting people into community connection and to be platforms for, you know, learning and engaging with information and issues and a global world we wouldn't have otherwise been able to. As much as I enjoyed reading a good newspaper in my youth, you know, social media certainly brings things to our attention in ways never before seen in our world. So
it brings the gospel to life. You know, Makah is going to remind us as we listen to him that, you know, faith is complex and we have to use, you know, the tools of the gospel to spread the good news and to work for change. So maybe that is a good reason to be on TikTok or to be real or to do any number of those things. I think you're spot on. We're so excited today to be joining this conversation with Makah. Today, we're going to be talking to Makah Black Elk of the Oglala Lakota Nation, who is the Executive Director for Truth and Healing at Red Cloud School in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, a former Indian boarding school. Makah is a graduate of the University of San Francisco and holds master's degrees in peace and human rights education from Columbia University and in educational leadership from the University of Notre Dame. Before he was the executive director at Red Cloud, he was a teacher and an educational administrator.
As a descendant of boarding school survivors, Makah brings a passion for interreligious dialogue to his work. He also serves as chaplain of the American Indian Catholic Schools Network and advocates for truth and healing in Catholic ministries and schools serving Indigenous peoples. Makah is a renowned voice in addressing the aftermath and damage caused by Indigenous boarding schools. And we're looking forward to talking to him today about his justice and reconciliation work and about the importance of truth and healing.
Absolutely. Let's get to it. Welcome, Makah.
Welcome.
Thanks to both of you for having me here. I really appreciate it.
Let's start with just introduce yourself to us and to our listeners and the good work you're doing at the Truth and Reconciliation Project.
Thank you. Yeah, sure. It's always a little humbling to have to introduce myself after such a luminous introduction from you all. But as was said, my name is Makah Black Elk. I work for Makbiluta Red Cloud. And have for the past 9 years in various roles. I was a teacher, educational administrator, as you said, and for the past 2.5 years have been in this position as executive director for truth and healing. So that came about in the summer of 2019 initially because the school, we finally sort of had our first non-Jesuit president. Mm. And so we had our very first lay president. He is not himself Lakota. He is a white man, but he came into the institution and did what a lot of new presidents do and asked people what the challenges were, what the successes were, what are we doing well and what can we do better. And overwhelmingly, he started to realize what a lot of us who are local had been there for a long time. I was a student at Red Cloud. What we all are kind of already knew, which was there's really deep-seated tension and mixed emotions and history that is rooted in our previous existence as a boarding school that needed to be addressed in some way, shape, or form. So that year he asked myself and another Jesuit actually to form a committee of people to spend a year exploring what truth and reconciliation was or wasn't. And so we called that our sort of year of learning. And then after that year of learning, I stepped into this full-time role. And it's been quite a journey through a pandemic, right? It's hard to do the work of truth reconciliation through a pandemic.
We all feel that.
Healing over Zoom, I don't know how realistic that is, but...
Yes.
But today we're doing a lot to address this history and this issue, and it's come with so many, I think, incredible moments of learning, of healing, of difficulty, but ultimately extremely worth it.
That's wonderful, Makah. I think it is such a difficult thing to do in person and then to have to do it over Zoom. I can only imagine the added struggle that added to the process. You said when you started, kind of when the committee came together and you asked this question, you know, what is truth and reconciliation? So what did you uncover? What did you find in yourself in that process? And what did the committee kind of uncover in that?
Yeah, so we spent that year really looking at scholarship, but also looking at other places that had performed truth and reconciliation commissions, obviously most famously South Africa in post-apartheid times, mm-hmm. And most recently Canada, which had a truth and reconciliation commission on this very specific topic of residential schools in Canada. And through all of that, we also asked community members, people who were prominently a part of our community, both within the Mahbialuta Red Cloud sphere, but also those outside of it, asked them the question, what they thought of truth and reconciliation, what they would think if Red Cloud engaged in something like that, what would be important for us to think about. So it was a year spent learning together with this committee, and the committee itself was diverse. It was made up of Indigenous peoples who are Catholic, Indigenous peoples who aren't Catholic, and non-Indigenous, both lay and Jesuit. We tried to get a representation of kind of our whole staff, which is made up of all those folks. Mm. And so that was an important part of it, because that group also served as a kind of microcosm for what we anticipated conversations would be, and how they would go and what kinds of topics would come up. And I think what we learned first and foremost was that we knew that in moving forward, seeking to do this in a full-time capacity, that was one of our ultimate recommendations, was that someone be committed to supporting the institution moving through a process like this. We decided the term reconciliation wasn't something that we mm-hmm. felt would be beneficial in this space and in this time. We know very deeply that the word reconciliation is so fundamental in our Catholic faith, and thinking about what that means and what that is and what Christ calls us to do, what our sacraments call us to do. But that the term reconciliation in a political sense doesn't really fit well for what Indigenous folks are understanding as their process mm-hmm. and what a meaningful process would be for them. Mm-hmm. And I think the primary sort of rationale for that is that reconciliation implies that two people, you know, at the individual level, are coming to a table as equals, and that there is a sense of needing for each side to, you know, hear the other and sort of come to a reconciled relationship, that there was once right relationship and then there was a wrong, and now there needs to be a return to right relationship. And many Indigenous peoples just don't feel that that is the relationship they have with their governments. We're certainly not entering that table as equals. Mm-hmm. There is one side of the equation that will likely never put all things on the table in terms of what reconciliation means, such as land return, fuller sovereignty, right? I mean, there are just things that aren't on the table. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that from a political lens, reconciliation isn't possible. Mm. And so then we felt that it was important to honor that, but to also acknowledge that despite some of those limitations, healing is still possible in this paradigm, especially on the individual level. And so that we needed to recognize that while reconciliation from that political lens may not be the best word to describe this process, that healing is still possible and speaks to what we can accomplish.
That is really powerful. And there's so many thoughts and feelings running around as I'm listening to you. And one of the things that emerges for me is an awareness that there might be people tuning in to listen to us who aren't as well informed about what some of these reference points might be. Some of that is reference to things you're talking about, like, you know, land reparations and things, but also with this Indigenous boarding school history, there's a very specific story there as well. And so I'm just wondering if you could explain a little more what happened, because I imagine some people might not be as well informed.
Yeah, the history of boarding schools and residential schools in the United States and Canada is intimately linked with the history of certainly the U.S. relationship with Native peoples writ large. And it goes beyond even these two countries, right? The tendency of colonial powers to take the Indigenous population and find that if through direct genocidal action, such as warfare, that a sort of indirect genocidal approach is also possible. And that happened primarily through removal of children from families and evolved over time. But it has its origins in the middle of the 1800s. At the time, many tribes, especially in the Great Plains and in the West, were still in fairly new contact with American society, white society. And though there had been a lot of history already with our East Coast relatives, the boarding schools hadn't quite found themselves as a popular movement at this point. Day schools were mostly a thing in Native communities, but at the time, many teachers, who were often white women on the frontier, found that each day as the students would travel back to their camps and stay with their parents, that the next day, any and all learning that had happened was lost. And the sense of, you know, as long as they're still connected to their savage families, that they'll never be able to transition and assimilate and adapt to our way of life and our language. So that was a feeling that was being expressed by a lot of day school teachers in these one-room schoolhouses in the middle of Indian territories that, you know, had limited resources and they weren't seeing progress in terms of what that meant to them. The other factor was that there was a man named Captain Richard Henry Pratt, who was a Civil War veteran, who at one point in his career had taken in some prisoners of war who were Indian men, Native men, who were sort of his hostages. And during their time spent with him as his prisoners of war, he dressed them in Western clothing and taught them how to speak English. He even took photographs of them as kind of before and after. And he took that and sort of presented that to Congress and said, this is what is possible. And that sort of became the basis for the initial investment that Congress put into the earliest boarding schools. And Captain Richard Henry Pratt founded one of the earliest that then became the model for a lot of others, most famously known as the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And that school is now sort of infamous in its grandeur in terms of the amount of students that it took in. Took in is a kind word for what the reality is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Many of the students came from hundreds of miles away. You know, these were students from the southwestern tribes in the desert regions, right? These were students from the northern Great Plains.
Oh, wow.
Who had to hop on trains and travel all the way to Pennsylvania, hundreds of miles away, take ferries up the Mississippi. And, you know, it was a long journey to get to that school. And then they spent the rest of their lives there. And they were heading there as young as, you know, 5 years old. And so the general model of boarding schools, starting with Carlisle and then moving into Canada and the rest of the United States, was that, you know, again, these were students who were pulled from their families and communities initially by threat of punishment. Families had to send their students to these schools. Mm. Otherwise, the punishment would be either imprisonment. And we know that from the record of parents being imprisoned at Alcatraz for the crime of not sending their children to boarding school.
Wow.
Another common punishment was the withholding of government rations, which in the 1800s and early reservation era, Native people were entirely reliant on government rations to live. And so it was essentially forced starvation with the withholding of rations. So parents had no choice but to send their kids to these schools. The schools themselves were often designed through in a sort of military fashion. Students were grouped into sort of these smaller regiments where older kids were kind of told to be these leaders, and they had this sort of military style in terms of how they were marched around and how they moved from place to place. The students also generally provided the labor for these institutions to exist, much like today. Federal schools that serve Native communities are incredibly underfunded, and that was true back then as well. These schools, while they received federal funding, both the ones who were run directly by federal dollars and by federal agencies, but also those that were religious, many received federal funding to operate. They all had this approach that they needed to utilize student labor in order to make up the difference. And so they would have farms and ranches often attached to them. Any of the work that needed to be done was also done with the students' labor. So boys not only learned how to do different trade skills, carpentry, metallurgy, they were also, you know, butchering the animals and tending to them. They were also milking cows and tending to the farm. And then girls similarly were trained in sort of domestic labor. So they were taught how to sew, how to clean, cook, would run the kitchens and larders, right? So the students were utilized as domestic labor, and they were usually spent half of their day doing that and the other half of their day learning reading, writing, and arithmetic. And Richard Henry Pratt, who again founded the Carlisle Indian Industrial School, is most famous for the quote that is used to sort of describe the very purpose of these schools, which he said was to kill the Indian and save the man, of the full quote being to kill the Indian in him and to save the human. And that was the purpose of these schools. And I think that fairly described what the goal was. Even those that were run by religious organizations, including the Catholic Church and numerous orders of Catholic religious that operated these schools. We know that over 100 of them were likely run by the Catholic Church.
Yeah. Maka, thank you so much. I think it's so difficult to hear and to even take in kind of the magnitude of really what was cultural genocide and what was forced assimilation and forced labor. And I know Aaron and I have talked about this, you know, oftentimes when we talk to our sisters, you know, our sisters will say, oh, well, we didn't run a boarding school. We weren't there. And saying, it's not about that. It's not about, you know, was our particular congregation there? It's about a larger sense of relationship. And what you said at the very beginning, when you talked about reconciliation, that reconciliation presumes that there's an equal relationship when we begin and say, in this case, there never was. There was never a right relationship. And in the case of boarding schools, a culture was actively disassembled and devastated by these schools. But that quote from the Carlisle School of, you know, to save the man, it's tragic and awful. And to recognize that we bear responsibility in that the entire church bears responsibility in that, and that we bear responsibility for one another. And that the generational trauma then that brings on, that, you know, families were sending their children, they were kind of coerced to send their children to these schools. And so the generational trauma then that brings into the picture, and how that exists on the reservation. And now, knowing that you yourself, you were a student at Red Cloud and you taught at Red Cloud, and now you're in this role doing the work of healing, I wonder what helps to sustain you in the work that you do? Because I would imagine it's such a difficult place to occupy, to hold, you know, the identity that you hold, to be Lakota, to also be Catholic, to be working for the Jesuits and also seeking healing with the community. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about that, about your own, how your own faith holds you up and grounds you in the work that you do.
There is a lot to say there. Thank you for the question. Well, one, I will say that what I just described is a very large and sort of probably the overarching narrative of the boarding school history. And it's important to understand that and recognize its origin and recognize the systemic way that the boarding school tried to, and in some ways succeeded and in other ways failed, to enact a cultural genocide. And so it's important to know that that's this greater arching narrative. Where it gets difficult, and I think will also answer your question in terms of how I sustain myself and sort of where healing comes into this picture is that it's also a complex story. It's very difficult, I think, especially when we're talking about history. And I think we see that, you know, as a former history teacher, I'm deeply connected to the conversations that are happening in this country about critical race theory and how we talk about American history and what is the quote unquote correct story to tell and how do we tell it. So it's easy to make the boarding school history a very black and white history. And in some ways, there's some truth to that, right? We can recognize the wholeness of the destruction that was attempted and was in many ways the rationale. In other ways, we hear this from boarders themselves, right? Especially those who are alive today still, some of the oldest people who went to these schools, who are now in their 80s and 90s, who would have gone to the school in the 30s and 40s. So those are some of the oldest folks we can get. And that's still sort of peak assimilation-minded era. And what we hear is a complex story, one that goes to the very heart of some of the challenges and the grayness of this history. For example, I mean, the very fact that boarding schools are wrapped up in the concept of school and education, I think any person would recognize, well, I think we generally think of education as a good thing. I think we generally think of schooling as an overall good thing. We can recognize the ways in which schools fail in numerous ways to achieve that. But that overall, there's this hope in education. There's this feeling that education is a good thing. Many alumni from these schools do talk about the value of the education they got. They don't necessarily dislike the fact that they, for example, learned how to speak English really well, or the things that they learned and read weren't interesting to them. I can speak from personal experience in hearing some of the many boarders who we've talked to. We use the term boarders and survivors because some prefer the term survivor and others don't. In hearing their stories, there are people who come in to that space of sharing, and they come in initially in a space of anger because their experience was largely negative. And they begin by telling those stories of pain and anger. And then as time moves on, as we let them continue to speak, because that's what I hate to even use the term let. I mean, we're just hearing them tell their story and allowing them all the time necessary that they need to do that. Even people who come in initially with very negative stories to tell can't help but tell some of their positive stories as well. For example, there was an elderly woman who started off again really, really telling the story of some of the cruelness that she witnessed and the cruelness that she experienced, and then couldn't help but talk about her love for having learned Latin, which was, you know, very
remarkable.
Right.
And specific to our Catholic school context, right?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
and just her love for learning Latin, how that really inspired her to become a writer later on and encourage her love for language in general and communication and how we talk. And that was all on her. We didn't prompt that, right? Mm. And then similarly, folks who come in really insisting that their experience was positive, that they loved their time at Holy Rosary Mission, which is what we were called back then, that they had nothing but good experiences, that there were so many Jesuits and sisters that they remember fondly. Even when they start to tell their story over time, can't help but start to talk about what was difficult. They can't help but start to talk about the separation from family, being dropped off, you know, at the school when they're 5, 6 years old and seeing their parents leave and wondering why. Or, you know, especially the use of corporal punishment and how in some ways that led to a lot of shame or even just the ways that they parented later on in their lives and how that contributed to a family dynamic that was cold and rooted in corporal punishment. And so even those who come in with that sense of fond memory, can't help but also communicate some of the pain. And the reason why I bring those two examples up is because it speaks to what I think is the ultimate challenge that we have in the process of truth, reconciliation, and healing, which is that this is a complex history. It's a very gray history. It's a history where we have to hold two seemingly opposing truths and hold them in tension and hold them to be both true at the same time, mm-hmm. which is that the boarding school system was devastating, harmful, systemically purposeful in its attempt to eradicate Native culture, language, spirituality, and to undermine Native families. And that at the same time, there were sincere people working in this system to try and educate in the boarding system itself, that the children who attended them made friendships, lifelong friendships, found marriages and relationships, learned a trade, found a vocation. Mm-hmm. And that all of those things are true at the exact same time. And it's really hard to hold those things true at the exact same time.
Yeah.
So I say all that to say that the way I sustain myself through my own faith is to recognize that this isn't a black and white story. Mm. And that I think the thing that's such a challenge for folks when they start to come to terms with this is it feels to people that one should cancel the other out. That, you know, if people are telling painful stories and then they can also tell positive stories, that doesn't that somehow, you know, mitigate the painful stories? And the answer is no, it doesn't. People still need to heal from harm, and harm was still committed. And so that's what we sort of focus on and what I think is still important. And one, I think our Catholic faith isn't against that. And that's why I really appreciate, I will say, this work was much harder before the publishing of a particular article that I think really helped frame for me the work moving forward. And that is an article that was written by Brett Salkeld. He's a theologian from the Archdiocese of Regina in Canada. And he wrote an article that was published in the Church Life Journal at the University of Notre Dame. So he wrote this article in the wake of what happened in Canada last year, right? That some of your listeners might be familiar with, but if they're not familiar, you know, Canada again went through a very tumultuous countrywide engagement in their residential school history when numerous former Indian boarding school, Indian residential school campuses had sort of rediscovered unmarked graves from the students who died there. And so Canada sort of went through this, you know, this whole reawakening of this history and the trauma associated with it. And he wrote in the wake of that, this article, that first he recognized that, especially when it came to Catholics looking at this history for the first time, especially, that there are often two responses that are typically rooted in people's politics. You know, he saw on one hand, people whose faith was again shaken in the church and who reacted to this history as a way of sort of saying, oh, once again, another failure of this church, a sort of lamenting of the ways in which this church just continues to show human failure, especially, you know, connected to other failures of this church, right? In light of the sexual abuse crisis and now this boarding school history, right? And so he said that was one response, to see the shaking of faith and this sort of lamentation. And then the other response he saw was a defensiveness, right? A desire to defend the church and to sort of try and make excuses for the church's role in this history. And he thought, I don't want to look at this history from either of those perspectives. I want to look at this history in terms of what my faith says, what's the theological lens that isn't being looked at. And he came up with, I think, a very profound and very challenging, but ultimately, I think, very accurate conclusion. And he said that the involvement of the Catholic Church in Canada's residential school history was, to be blunt, heretical. That the church should never have been involved in the running of these schools for two particular theological reasons. The first was that it was a direct repudiation of the First Council of Jerusalem. And for listeners who aren't aware, the First Council of Jerusalem was an early moment in church history when Greek people were first beginning to convert to Christianity. And St. Peter in the early church leadership were arguing whether or not the Greeks who were converting should also become culturally Jewish. Mm-hmm. And the conclusion and the argument that St. Peter himself vociferously argued for was that no, they did not have to become culturally Jewish in order to become followers of Christ. And that was when the church decided that it was not a church of any one culture. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yet the church was involved in a system that explicitly told native peoples that they could not be of their culture in order to become American, Canadian, and certainly Christians.
Yeah.
And then the second thing that he pointed to was the Catholic belief in family as the first teacher, rooted in our devotion to the Holy Family, rooted in our belief in the concept of subsidiarity. And yet we were involved as a church in a system that very explicitly said parents are not the first educator, that very explicitly removed children from their families on purpose because that was seen as the right thing to do. And so he says, based on those two things alone, regardless of any other arguments one could even try to make, he says the church should never have been involved in this project. And he also says for the people who would be defensive and say, but wait, didn't people believe that they were doing a good thing? Didn't people believe that they were helping Native people adapt to this new world that was inevitable, right? Mm. He says, well, that doesn't really matter, because what good is a church whose moral compass is determined by the culture of the time and the values of the time and what is seen as right at the time? If we claim to hold a universal truth, that truth should be true 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, and 100 years from now. He says that to say, look, we shouldn't excuse this. We don't have to defend it as Catholics. And we can be angry and we can seek to be sacramental about this, meaning we should atone, we should do penance, we should reconcile. We should do the things that we need to do to recognize that, you know, our God is a God who has been on the side of the oppressed over and over and over again. A God who has been on the side of the meek and the lowly. And as a church, we have to ask ourselves, when we as a church were in the position of power, and in this case, were one of the oppressors and the progenitors of harm, what do we do? What is our calling?
That's a really important point right there. I just want to grab that because I think that is such an important point. And it's so relevant to right here and now too. Like, we're talking about it somewhat in this context of what has been, but yet as you're saying this, this is so relevant to a number of other critical issues of our time right now. And I suspect continues to be part of, as you said, I like really powerful points around, you know, life doesn't always fit in these black or white boxes that as people of faith we're called to be engaged and informed, but also prayerful and discerning, because life is these gray tension points. And things don't always have this clear compass kind of forward. But yet what you're outlining really talks about the importance, though, that Christ's teachings do have some pretty clear forward lines here. And when our church, when our institutions, when our governments align themselves more along privilege and power, what happens to our institutions, our churches, to our own personal faith? Because I think that this is so relatable to so many of us in the work we're doing in a number of arenas. And I think it's a point of exploration in terms of our own personal experiences as well, too, that in this work that many people are doing right now in terms of anti-racism work, you know, LGBTQIA inclusion, you know, areas around justice for immigrants. Like, these are some really important points there to kind of grab and pull out. And a little pivot point too, because I think this is something for us as Sisters of St. Joseph, you know, our charism, our spirituality is so rooted in unioning love, sort of this loving God and neighbor without distinction. And this is something we reflect on. What does that mean in the signs of today's times? How do we be sisters and associates, partners in mission, doing all things that we're capable of doing to create a more loving, just, and inclusive world, to be prophets? Pivoting slightly to say, like, how do you see some of this right now for us here, for those listening? Like, what are things that we could do here and now, whether it's personal prayer, whether it's systemic change, action? I mean, I think that's something that many people listening might say, wow, all of this is bringing up so many thoughts and questions. And like, what do I do with this? Because I know that's something I sometimes feel like. I now find myself standing in this tension point, and what do I do? And I, you know that that's probably a long, complicated answer. So I guess the simple question there is just, you know, would you be able to name for us, in light of some of this, what could be some personal invitation to prayer and or action in light of everything you've shared?
No, thank you. It's a powerful and good question. And I think, to keep rehashing Brett Salkeld in his great article, like I said, it really helped me personally, because not only does he obviously, you know, state this very clear challenge to the church that says, look, what we did as a church in being involved in these boarding schools was not only heretical, and those who are defending it, you shouldn't defend it, and for all these reasons. He also says, and to those whose response is a shaking of faith, right? For those who this is, you know, another failure of this church, he invites, and I think what was a blessing for me in terms of reading this article was a renewal of faith, right? That it doesn't matter if this history is necessarily a stain on the church, because what it invites us to as a church is to live out our sacraments and to recognize what our gospel teaches us, what Christ teaches us, and to then actually do it, right? To actually do the work of meeting people and of attempting that healing journey, right? That all of the things that our faith calls us to, that this is our chance to live it and do it and earn it again, which for me was, again, a very powerful reminder that though this church certainly has had its human failures, that truth, that gospel truth that was true 1,000 years ago and is true 1,000 years from now, is what's good about this faith and is the rock that continues to hold me to Christ's vision and recognize that this can be done, that this is possible, that it's important for us to be reminded of our baptismal calling in that way. And so that's where that sort of personally, I think, invited me. And I think it also invited me to, and what I've sort of been speaking on recently is, we talk about the barriers that exist to healing. So I'll just quickly say this, right? Like, truth and reconciliation, as it's been done in other places, especially as it's been done by governments, whether that's the government of South Africa or Canada, or, you know, there's been various truth and reconciliation efforts in Latin America, there's always a start and a stop, right? Like, we start doing something, we start listening to the peoples who are directly impacted, we do some investigation of that, we come up with some conclusions, and then the reconciliation ends. And there's a stopping point. And I think we see in Canada, just based on what happened last year with the news story, that that's just not how this works. And we learned that even in our own journey, that one, there's no such thing as collective healing, in that there is nothing the church can do, or that we as an institution, Makbia Luta Red Cloud, can do, that will just, you know, cause healing to happen for a mass amount of people, and then we can call it done, right? That healing is always an individual journey. And that we are responsible, therefore, as a church, not I'll just say again, because I think there are people who might hear that word responsible and think, but we didn't, today I had nothing to do with what happened in the past. Right. And correct. Right. No one person is responsible for what happened in the past, and no individual person should hold the responsibility, weight, and guilt of what happened in the past. What we are responsible for is the relationship moving forward. What we are responsible for is the healing we can commit to today and what that looks like in the future. And so institutionally, we've seen ourselves as sort of being, we are required, not out of, some sort of guilt, but required out of what our faith calls us to do all the things necessary that might help individuals achieve some sort of healing. Mm-hmm. And recognizing that that's going to be different for everyone. And I think the Pope's apology recently, this summer, in Canada, serves as a great example, right?
Yeah.
For some Indigenous peoples in Canada, the United States, and elsewhere, the apology was not enough. The apology was not welcome. The apology was insincere. The apology didn't say what it should have said. An apology will never be enough, right? For some Native people, the apology was even offensive, right? And that's just going to be true no matter what. For other Native peoples, the apology was what they needed in order to achieve something closer to healing. And I think what is so powerful then about the Pope's apology is that, one, it did that for some Native people, right? It served as a really important first step. But it also called upon the whole body of Christ to do this work of building right relationship of truth and healing, and hopefully ultimately reconciliation from the theological perspective. So I say that to talk about, I mentioned, right, we have these barriers to healing. There are always going to be barriers to healing for individuals. And we talk about three in particular. That first and foremost, people have to want to heal. And for many, many Native peoples, it's very hard to even achieve that step, because the anger that one feels towards the government, towards the church, towards this history, it's serving some sort of purpose for survival, right? And to want to heal means letting go in some ways of that anger. And we're under no, as an institution, pretense that we're able to do anything about that, other than to sort of help people recognize that to hold on to that anger is actually ultimately harmful to one's soul, to one's body, to desire healing is to let go of something that is actually ultimately harmful to yourself. The second barrier to healing is you need to believe that healing is possible. And this history feels so big and so overwhelming that many people, I think, could easily jump to the conclusion that this is not, healing is not possible in this regard. And I think the Pope said it really well when he said, it may not matter. The church may never be able to do anything that would be enough, right, for healing. But that does not preclude our need and calling to try. So we have to believe it's possible, even if it doesn't always feel that way. And then the final barrier that we talk about is that you have to feel worthy of healing. And that is why I think the reminder of my baptismal calling, the reminder of the truth and goodness of this faith, is to me a reminder that this church is worthy of healing and worthy of forgiveness. It's all of our job to make the church and be a church that is worthy of that.
Maka, that is, just beautiful. I think it is. That is our call as a church, to be the body of Christ and to continue seeking healing. You said we're not done yet. A healing process is not one and done. There's no end in sight. There's no end in sight to the complexity that our faith can hold, but there should be no end in sight to our desire for healing, the possibility for healing, and also our worthiness for healing. So thank you so much for spending this time with us, for sharing your own faith, your own journey, this process that is underway and is in no way close to done, because we as a church will continue to seek healing and to seek right relationship, to seek kinship within our God who is love and who calls us to love each and every day and in all of our relationships. So thank you so much for the wisdom that you shared, for your life experience, and for the work that you do. It enriches us, but it enriches our whole world and draws us together in that way. Now, at the end of each one of our episodes, Maka, we like to do a little bit of a lightning round. You know, we've talked about some really serious stuff today. And so we just have some, you know, fun questions to kind of end our day.
We didn't warn him that we were going to do this.
So hopefully you'll go along for the ride with us, okay?
Do my best.
Whatever the first thing that comes to mind. So this is going to be like rapid fire questions and just name the first thing. They're fun.
So the first question I have for you, Maka, is what is the last TV show or movie that you watched and loved?
Ooh, I would have to say it was Reservation Dogs, which is on Hulu. It's one of the first shows that is a mainstream show starring Native peoples on a reservation. And it's a dramedy comedy. So it's both funny and also very real. So it's a great show. And they just had a second season.
Love
Highly
it.
Recommend.
What is your favorite game?
My favorite game?
Yeah.
Well, it depends what you mean by game.
I can interpret it however you'd like to.
Well, I'm actually kind of an avid gamer in the sense of I do tabletop games, board games, and video games. And of course, there's also, right, like sports games, which I'm less good at, but do have some favorites. I am a big nerd. So I will say my favorite game is I'm a huge fan of the Final Fantasy series, which is a video game series.
Love it. Great.
Now, we just had this wonderful conversation, but if you could have a conversation with anyone except for us, who would it be?
I could have a conversation with anyone. That's a very good question. I mean, in the context of this conversation, I would love to have a conversation with Pope Francis.
Mm-hmm. Who's your favorite saint?
My favorite saint is, several come to mind. I'm a personal fan of Saint Kateri Tekakwitha, and also I am a fan of Saint Juan Diego and also Guadalupe. And then, of course, I'm a descendant of an aspiring saint who hopefully one day will be one, Nicholas Black Elk.
Oh, we will keep on praying with Nicholas Black Elk. And maybe one final question, Maka, and that is, you talked about kind of the reintroduction and teaching the Lakota language at Red Cloud. Do you have a favorite Lakota word that you could share with us?
Yes, I do. It's sort of cliche because it's, I don't know, but it's also just, things that are cliche are also often just very true and right and correct. So we have a word that we use similarly to the way Christians use amen. So it's like the ending of all of our prayers. And it's mitakaye oyasi, and it comes from, mitakaye means sort of our relatives, our relations, those who are connected to us through as family. And then oyasi is sort of like this all-encompassing wholeness. And we say it at the end of prayers because it's a reminder of we are all related, meaning not just human beings, but our land, the relatives that also live on this land, from all the animals and the insects and the growing things. So it's this constant reminder of our relationships to the wholeness of creation. And then usually when we greet people, like a whole crowd, I usually say, how mitakiyepi, like hello, my relatives, right? So mitakiyepi is my favorite word because I think it's just a reminder of relationship.
I love it. And what a perfect ending. I think that's a perfect ending note right there. And so thank you so much, Maka. It has been fantastic talking with you. I feel that you have given me personally a lot to think about, to pray about, to reflect on, and to aspire to. So again, thank you. It's been wonderful. And
you.
We look forward to talking with you again in the future. Thank you.
You as well.
Many blessings.
You've been listening to Beyond the Habit, If you enjoyed listening to us today, be sure to subscribe so that you never miss an episode. We appreciate any kind reviews you might want to leave us. Also, be sure to follow us on social media. Smash that like and subscribe button, or send us an email at beyondthehabitpod@gmail.com.
Thank you to our guest, Macaw Blackout, for being in conversation with us today. Thank you also to all those who have made this podcast possible, especially our sisters from the Congregation of St. Joseph and the Sisters of St. Joseph of Philadelphia, our sound editor, Angie Hayes, our music composer, Matthew Dolan, our producer, Elizabeth Powers, and Sister Sarah Simmons, who works with us on preparing these episodes.
We look forward to sharing more with you next time. I love mailing a good Hallmark card.
A carrier pigeon, if you still have them.
You want a telegraph? I could send you a telegraph. Da 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 da.